Wondering how you view your accomplishments, successes, and failures.
Well, I'd like to say that first and foremost, I have been the wife of a rabbi. That has been, to my mind, the important part of my life. Everything else is secondary, even though I have loved my writing and have considered it important. Important because I felt I've pioneered in some respects. But being the wife of a rabbi is a very satisfying, a soul-satisfying thing. Of course, I've had the advantage of being the wife of a tremendous rabbi, of a great rabbi. It has not only the enrichment of life, but the fulfillment of many friendships. Dr. Vihoff has himself been interested in handcrafts, and so he has always encouraged me in the things I have done. I might not have done as much if I'd had a husband who looked kind of askance at my handwork, but I've loved doing crocheting and needlepoint and so forth. And my music, I had been a pianist. I had studied piano for several years and had worked very hard at it. And then in recent years, I studied the recorder. The Friedhoff family all loves to sing, and I can't sing because I had an adult tonsillectomy, and so I went from a soprano to a basso, and I can't carry a tune very well, though I whistle. And one day at services, Mrs. Jacob turned to me, she heard me whistling, and she looked at me, and I said, "Well, you've heard of the Flying Nun, I'm the Whistling Rabbitson." But we had traveled once to Yosemite with Dr. Vihoff's brother and his wife. She had been a dancer and is a musician. And she was sitting on my bed playing her recorder, and the two brothers were singing and having a wonderful time, and I was very jealous. I said, "Florence, I can't carry my piano on my back. I'd love to learn the recorder." So we got back to San Francisco. She helped me buy a recorder. She gave me two lessons, and we went then to Saratoga, where Dr. Vihoff was to be a rabbi in residence for a week at this Union of American Hebrew Congregations camp. And there I sat and tootled, making terrible sounds and mistakes, when one day the man in the cabin next to me said, "You're doing something a little wrong. May I show you?" And he showed me what it was I was doing wrong. He was only the cantor of the camp, and I was so embarrassed. Well, I started to learn to play this on my own because I didn't have to be taught music. I knew about music. I just had to learn breath control and how to play the recorder. And so I did go to get a teacher, Mary Hoover. Her husband was at the University of Pittsburgh, and took some lessons with Mary Hoover. And now I carry my recorder wherever we travel, and then whenever Dr. Vihoff feels like singing, I play the recorder. He drops an octave, and he can harmonize with that, and it's great fun. One of the great satisfactions, too, as I adverted to being married to Dr. Vihoff, is this intense interest always in learning something new. It has been my great regret that all of these years I had not studied Hebrew properly. Every summer I would say, "This summer I'm going to study Hebrew," and I would take some material with me, and then one summer I memorized the 23rd Psalm, and that was as far as I got, and it bothered me very much. I had taken Hebrew at the University of Wisconsin, but I had a very poor teacher there. I had a choice between two teachers, the professor of the department, who was Dr. Kelly, and a Jewish teacher, and I thought I'd learn more from the Jewish teacher. But to my regret, he was a misanthrope, a cripple, and spent all of the year talking about anti-Semitism at Harvard. So I learned very little Hebrew from him. I learned the alphabet, virtually all. And years later, Dr. Vihoff said to me, "You had a chance to study with the great Professor Kelly?" I said I didn't know at the age of 17 that he was a great Professor Kelly. And I've lived with this Hebrew scholar for 41 years and never took advantage of it. This summer, I said, it is different, and I started this summer. And I said to Dr. Vihoff, "I want first just to read. I want classical Hebrew. I don't expect we'll be going back to Israel, and so conversational Hebrew is not what I need. I want classical Hebrew." I want my tongue and my ear to get so familiar with it, then I will learn to go back to grammar and learn what I'm talking about. And he started me off. 1 hour every day now, I have been reading Hebrew aloud to him. I am reading the book of Psalms. I just finished the fourth book of Psalms. I'm on the last book of Psalms, and I am so thrilled with that. Now, I mention that because I think it is so important that no matter what your age, you should keep on studying something. That's what Dr. Freehoff does, that's what he has taught me to do, and that has been one of the tremendous satisfactions. You asked me about my failures. Well, up until this year, Hebrew was my failure. My other failure is that I did not get to spend as much time with my music as I would have wanted to. I wasn't a virtuoso by any means. But for my own pleasure, I would have liked to have done more. But you know, it is true that you have that many hours in a day. It is also true that we usually do what we want to do. Well, I feel for the most part I have. I've been able to accomplish most of the things I've wanted to do. But sometimes your time or your health doesn't permit that you do everything. I did have certain little periods of illness when I had to slow down or put things aside for a little while. Normally, I'm a quite healthy person, and I'm able to read better again, and so my reading is not a handicap as it was for a very short time. I think my writing, as I said, first and foremost, being the wife of the rabbi has been my great, great pleasure in life. It's been a wonderful life. We've just celebrated our 41st anniversary, and I think I've been a very lucky woman to have had such a wonderful life with such a wonderful man. I think secondarily, my writing has been my greatest satisfaction, because my writing was primarily in the field of children, for children. I think when you write for children, you feel that you have a chance of exerting some influence. You don't know. You never know what you accomplish. One hopes that one accomplishes something. You will remember back to your own school days, and there was some teacher who had an impress on you, or sometimes just a sentence that somebody has said somewhere along the line. So we never know. So we try to throw out as much as we can, hoping that we will capture the little minds as much as we can. I feel that my being the wife of the rabbi was my primary job. Mm-hmm. If we want to call it a job. You live a public life. You are in public view all the time. However, if you have had the kind of home training I had with my parents, who led me into leading what I call a respectable American life and a respectable Jewish life, and then you marry a man who is a religious leader, your own personality and your own character follow through. This may sound immodest. I'm not sure whether I'm sounding immodest. I don't mean to. But I do feel that I've lived a decent life. I have always had the feelings of other people under consideration. I've always been very sensitive to people and their feelings and their ideals and their wishes. I know that the congregants want their rabbi and their rabbi's wife to have good lives of their own, but they want them to be their exemplar in the community. You cannot be in religious work and lead just any old kind of a life. You've got to be upright, you've got to be upstanding, When one of Dr. Brehoff's assistants was interested in playing bridge, and he was a wonderful bridge player, Dr. Brehoff said to him, but you have to be very careful. You're playing with members, and you might say the wrong word to him, or in anger he might lash out at you. We do have to represent the best in the community, the best in the congregation. You're all good people. It isn't that we are better than you, but we must always be in a position where we cannot be criticized, where we must do the right thing. If you are walking down the street, another woman coming toward you may be chewing gum or wearing funny clothes or looking outlandish. That's at first place, it doesn't comport with my personality or character to do that. But as a rabbi's wife, I can't do those things. I can wear informal clothes such as slacks or pantsuits when we're off on vacation, but I can't wear them in Pittsburgh. Now, there's nothing wrong with slacks or a pantsuit, and nowadays particularly, but I'm still the rabbi's wife, and I would offend members of the congregation if they saw me acting in an unwholesome way in any situation. Yes, it curbs you to that extent. It curbs you to the extent that you do have to be on your good behavior. But I'm just lucky in that I was raised that way, so that being on my good behavior was second nature to me, I suppose. And again, I feel this is, it sounds immodest, but I don't mean it to be. But I'm not likely to do the sort of thing in public that would be reprehensible. Every once in a while, you do get the feeling that you wish you could have a little more privacy. You wish you could have a little more leeway to do certain things, but they're never that important, you know. But you do live a fishbowl existence. I went to the hospital for an appendectomy, and when the word got out that it was something entirely different, you know, that sort of thing. And you can be a little disturbed about something like that once in a while, but it's not important. It's still not important. The important thing is this, that you get from your congregation a tremendous amount of love and affection that you would not earn as a lawyer's wife or a doctor's wife. That has been one tremendous advantage. As the rabbi's wife, you occupy a special position in people's eyes, and they give you a respect and a love that you had better try to earn, because you're not a nice person if you don't earn that. You get it whether you deserve it or not. But it's a tremendous satisfaction that you do get all of that love and affection from the congregation. Our congregation has been one of the really unusual congregations in this country. It has for its rabbis unlimited respect. I don't say that other congregations may not respect their rabbis, but Road of Sholem has something special in it. It has always given to every one of its rabbis a tremendous amount of respect and love, and the wives also come under the same aura, you know. Now, one of the things that there are private things that you do, and your congregation doesn't always know all the things you do. They haven't known of my interest, particularly in music. I've been active in a little bit in the symphony. I've gone to symphony concerts and so forth. I was a foster parent for a Korean child for 2 years. No one in the congregation knows that because I just never told anybody. Not that there wasn't any reason. I just never mentioned it, that was all. But the one thing the congregation does know is that Dr. Freehoff and I have been great baseball fans always. He came from Cincinnati, a great fan of the Reds, but he very quickly became a Pirate fan. Now, I came from Chicago with three brothers, and knew nothing about baseball, which was surprising because we did indulge in many sports. And someone once said to me, how did you come from Chicago? You had baseball teams in Chicago. And I said, yes, we had a major team and a minor team. And he said, which was the minor team? And I said, the White Sox. He said, don't let the White Sox hear you say that. That's how much I knew about baseball in those days. Now, it came at the baseball season came at the time of the year when Dr. Phillips' work began to relax. He didn't play golf, and he needed to be able to get out in the open air and relax a bit. Football was different. That came when his work became heaviest, and he needed the time for sermon preparation and lecture preparation, so we never got to be great football fans. But the baseball season came at the time when we needed the relaxation, and he taught me everything I know about baseball. We lived within walking distance of the park, so it was wonderful. There was even one year when I knew the batting averages of all the Pirates. I don't anymore, but I did that one year. Well, when they moved to the north side, of course, we had to give up our interest because neither one of us drives a car. Most of the games are night games now, and you can't get stuck out on the north side at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning without a taxi. So we don't listen too much, and we don't pay too much attention to baseball anymore. And anyway, I think it's good and healthy and healthful to let your interest change from time to time. Now, while I had that tremendous interest in Braille, it was fine when I began my writing that another interest came into my ken and absorbed me. I give up one kind of handwork and go into another, or I give up one kind of music and go to another, and that's all right. I think that's good, because that keeps you on in the learning process. You're always learning something new. If you keep in the same interest that you always had, you can get pretty stultified after a while. I have never played cards very much. I love bridge, and I was a fairly good bridge player, but oh, I haven't played for many years because Dr. Freehoff didn't play cards, and I couldn't be out with him and either keep him waiting while I finished a hand or interrupt a game. So that was not important if I gave that up. If I could give up my dancing, I could give up my bridge very easily, you know, because there were so many things that we did together. Everything that we do together, we enjoy together. But I would like to end as I began, unless you know it, that the greatest satisfaction for me has been to be the wife of Rabbi Solomon B. Freehoff.
Well, thank you. We were discussing the embroidery book, Mrs. Freehoff, and you wanted to tell us something about what transpired during the writing.
Yes. Bucky and I wrote to people all over the world for pictures of old R curtains and old Torah mantles. We wanted to show in this book old things, the ancient, the antique things, as well as the modern. And we did get pictures from all over the world. There were too many for the book, and the publisher had to ask us to withdraw about 100 pictures. And of course, we had to comply with her request. The cover of the book has a picture of a famous Ark curtain that has a fascinating story to it. In the Middle Ages, the embroiderers were Jews. The goldsmiths we won't go into the goldsmiths. The embroiderers were Jews. And there was a famous embroiderer who was a member of the Naumburg family. They were a Cantoral family. Now, one of the first rabbis of this congregation was Rabbi Naumburg. He had a daughter, Carrie, who married one of the early presidents of the congregation, Josiah Cohen. Josiah Cohen was an Englishman, and Carrie Naumburg married Josiah Cohen. she was still alive when I came here, because she lived to be about 98, and so I knew Carrie Nelnberg very well. One of her ancestors was this Elkanan Nelnberg, who created three magnificent ark curtains. One of those ark curtains was last known in Augsburg, Germany, before the Nazis destroyed it. The last known rabbi of that congregation took a picture of that ark curtain, and that is the picture on the cover of our book. That rabbi was Dr. Ernst Jacob, the father of Walter Jacob, the present rabbi of this congregation, and the embroiderer was the distant relative of Carrie Nelnberg Cohn, the daughter of one of our early rabbis of this congregation. Isn't that a beautiful story?
All came to roost in Pittsburgh.
Yes, all came in Pittsburgh. Maker and a wonderful...
Excuse me. You talked a lot about your father at the beginning. What was your mother like?
My mother was a very attractive woman who was a wonderful homemaker and a great inspiration to her children. She was interested in everything we did. She encouraged us. She encouraged us to be independent. When I was 13 years old, my very best friend was an English girl who was very much heavier, bigger than I. I was a little bit of a thing. And I looked 11 for 13, and she looked 16. She came from a rather poor English family. And during that summer between grade school and high school, because I went into high school at 13, she wanted to work. Well, if she wanted to work, I had to get a job. My father was absolutely aghast. His daughter couldn't work. But I heard my mother arguing with him one day, and she said, "It's not going to hurt her. It's all right. Let her try. She won't get a job. Look how young she looks. No one is going to hire her. But if she wants to try, let her try." But I did get one. I got a position, and unbeknownst to me, my father went down and cased the joint, as they say in mysteries. I didn't know until years later my mother told me that he went down to see, because it was not in downtown Chicago, it was just outside. He went to see what the neighborhood was like, who was in the building, what businesses were in the building, whom I would come in contact with, and then reluctantly he let me. But my mother struggled for my independence, you see, because as I said earlier, my father was Victorian. He would have held me down. I would have been the sheltered daughter of the family, the secluded sheltered daughter, and my mother wouldn't permit that. She today would have been a woman's lib, I think. She was very forthright. She was a tremendous reader, and she had a tremendous sense of humor. Very even-tempered. My father was the quick-tempered one. From him I learned my quick temper. But my mother had an equable temperament, and very interested in her children, very eager for all of us to accomplish what we would want to accomplish.
And that was a much-needed addenda, because I didn't have a picture of what your mother was like.
Yes.
And this has a
Both of my parents' people came from the same town in Lithuania, Mariampol, the city of Mary is what it means. And surprisingly, their people did not know each other there. They only met in Chicago. And for years, my father used to tease and say it was a tiny town, that if a horse and wagon were going through, the horse was out of the town before the wagon was through. And as small children, we didn't realize that he was teasing. When I was working on the embroidery book with Bucky King, Dr. Friedhoff brought home to me a book written entirely in Hebrew, which was beyond me. He said, "Look at the pictures, and if there's something that you like particularly, I'll tell you what it is." I came across a picture of a very beautiful snow scene of a little town, a street in the town. And I said, "What is this, dear?" And he said, "Well, that's a picture of Mariampol. I never dreamed that I'd ever see such a picture." so I showed it to Bucky, and she had her husband photograph it, and then she translated it to canvas for me, and I needle-pointed that picture. I have it hanging in our bedroom. I don't know if any of my nieces and nephews will ever be interested in it, but I'm hoping that one niece who was interested in the family history will someday take that picture.
Well, you know, the happenstance, when you start to do research and what you find that has personal meaning to you, it's very exciting.
My father loved to tease us, so when we were very small, he'd say, I just came from the, there was a grocery store on the corner, and he said, I just came from the store and I saw the milkman, he was standing on the corner, he's just frozen there. And the kids would run out to see, you know. He loved to tease us like that. He was a very as Victorian as he was with me, he was that gentle with his children. He never touched a finger to any child. My mother had to be the disciplinarian because my father could not correct a child. Anything his children did was perfect, you know.